Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety. Welcome to Episode 3, the final episode of the George Menkoff series, the story of a B-17 bomb ordnance officer stationed in Great Ashfield, England, as part of the 385th Bomb Group during World War II. So far in the series, we met George as he entered military service and trained as an ordnance officer, and we follow him to Great Ashfield, England, where he described the daily routine of loading the bombs and ammunition on his B-17s. We also met his son, David Menkoff, who is our guest co-host for the series. We rejoin him now as he tells us about the danger of arming the bombs mid-flight, as well as the ever-present danger of mid-air collisions. Okay, so next we're going to get into, I ask him a question about how long does it actually take you to load a bomber?
The great question.
When the invasion started, we didn't have any time off at all. Sometimes we'd load maybe three loads a day.
How long would it take you to load one load?
Oh, you're getting the, I'd say I could get one done about 45 minutes, I think.
Really?
Oh, that's impressive.
But it's hard to say. You have to go out. You have to wait until you can get to the bombs, and then you back yours up, and you load yours. You hook it. You're already hooked to the trailer. I learned to back those trailers real straight. Mm-hmm. So you had to back them through the width of the bomb bay doors when they're wide open. So you have about 6 inches or 7 inches clearance on each side. So you had back really straight to get that in there. So see what you must say. Okay, but sometimes you have to drop them. You didn't get to, and you're chased by some German fighters or something, and you want to get your plane as light as you can, you might have to jettison unarmed. And you got another lever up there that the little thing that holds the wire opens up. And then you go ahead and drop the bombs. Well, that wire is still with the bomb. See? Because that's, you don't want them to blow up when it hits. It might be over some friend's houses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people's houses and don't want to kill anybody. You're not over the bomb, right? You're not over the target right now. So you can drop them either way. And I think when they go back and keep them, I believe the bombardier would go, he's the one that, sometimes they had an armor like I was on the as a gunner, on as a gunner. Hmm. And sometimes he'd do all that, pulling the cotter pin out. But they'd keep the cotter pin. And if they had to go back, well, they could, if they wanted to, they'd just leave the wires in there. But to be more safe, I guess, if you could just go take that wire out and put the cotter pin back in. Mm-hmm. Just have to stand with your legs apart in the bomb bays. It's divided in half. So it'd be 1, 2, 3, 4 racks. And you can walk right down between them. So each, the inside rack would be, and they weren't very wide to walk, about a foot and a half, I suppose. And, outside would be against the hull. But, so that was one of our, that would be our trip. Now those veins, I'm probably in this arming vein thing that I've got here.
I'm going to stop in real quick. He's going to start talking about these arming veins and how, what they had to do when the bombs did actually arm in flight before they were dropped. But, you know, I just wanted to talk about, he talks about the bomb racks and the bomb bays and everything. You know, we've been through some of these B-17s, and you know what's amazing, you know, as Tony and I have gone through these planes before, and anybody out there that's gone taking a tour through these planes, is, you know, they're made for 19, 20 year old kids that are 150 pounds, 140 pounds, You know, maybe the pilots are, you know, in their early 20s or something like that, but still, you know, fit and trim guys. They're not made for, you know, 54-year-old guys that weigh 200 plus pounds to be crawling through. But anyway, he talks about, you know, there's a very narrow catwalk that's in these bomb bays. And I remember walking through, I think it was the Liberty Bell B-17 for the first time. And I was amazed at how narrow. This is the bomb bay. This doesn't look very big at all, you know, and this whole plane is made for this little area right here, you know, but you think about it, you're crammed, all the bombs are crammed into this one space, got a little catwalk in between.
He says about 18 inches wide.
Yeah, a foot and a half. And you had this, basically you had to go kind of go sideways through it, you know, and when those bomb bay doors are open, that's, you know, if you're the bombardier guy walking around, you're on that catwalk above nothingness, you know, 28,000 feet up.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, you know, you go to the Grand Canyon, which is not 28,000 feet up.
Right.
And they've got that glass floor overhang.
I've never done
that. There's pictures of people walking out there and like crawling on the glass because it freaks them out. What's it like to be in this bomber freezing your butt off at 28,000 feet with the bomb bay doors open, walking across an 18-inch wide catwalk?
I can't imagine it because you think of the temperature and you got this 100-mile-an-hour wind.
The temperature, the noise, the vibration. What happens if you get into turbulence, which is going to happen, and you're on this catwalk full of bombs and you're walking through. At any rate, it just feels like something from another era because it is.
That's right.
There's no way we do that now.
Okay, so now he's going to get into talking a bit. This is a pretty interesting era at this coming into this right now, where he talks about some of these veins arming the bombs and what they had to do to kind of, you know, account for that.
Two flights when the Army vein unscrewed while in flight. And one of them that I can remember was... I don't know whether this is it or not. Talk City, Oklahoma, Truman Smith. Yeah, Truman Smith, one of the guys, pilot from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He wrote a book, The Wrong Stuff. So, 500-pound general demolition bombs, what they were called. And but one of them screwed up, but that was negligence of whoever pulled the wire through and didn't get the wire pulled through it. Put a collar pill in it, but didn't put the wire through it. Well, air coming through the bomb bay, well, they don't always fit real tight. It would be enough to just slowly do that, and the thing fell off.
So if the vein came off while it was still in the bomb racks,
yeah,
then it was armed.
It's armed right there.
So could any vibration set off the bomb?
Well, not any vibration, but it'd take more than that. But still, it's scary.
Mm.
It's very scary. And I think Truman said for him to go back and screw it back on. Well, in ordinance, I wouldn't want to do that. All right, and another time when an Army vein screwed off was when they were bombing them, and I don't know what caused it. Maybe the plane jostled a little bit, but one of them, the last one, they were over the target then. The last one sort of went kinked sideways, and of course they had already dropped and the wires were pulled out then, and so it became armed right there in the plane.
Oh, gosh.
And two guys were delegated to get over there and thousands of feet below them, and maybe someone had a cord and something holding them just in case. Their foot would be like this, standing up and your feet are wide apart and reaching over at the end, tail, and they were instructed to lift up the tail and the leading part of the bomb and raise it up, twist it around, and drop it. And they did that.
So let me get this straight. The bomb bay doors are open.
Yeah.
These guys are standing straddled over nothing.
Nothing but space.
Nothing but space and wind.
And they may have had on shoes.
And they were instructed, since these bombs had already armed.
One bomb.
They had to lift it up and twist it and drop it out of fire.
Either that or lift it up a little bit and kick it or something to kick it out of there.
I don't think I'd want to kick an armed bomb.
Well, you wouldn't kick it that hard. It'd take a pretty good blow to enough inertia to have that to go through and detonate the bomb. But they didn't. I'm sure they didn't kick that much, if they kicked it at all. I would imagine they just sort of pushed it off of the part of the plane or the part of the bomb bay door that was just holding it all it had, or just give it a push off of it.
Wow. And
that was dangerous work.
That's dangerous work.
And but those two I remember. And we had two of our planes have a collision.
I'm going to jump in right there because he's going on to the next story here about some collisions that happened. But I just want to just kind of, that was their opening clip, you know, segment there. I just don't know that I could ever get myself to kick a live bomb. I mean, I don't think
I could get myself to stand over the bomb bay with the bomb bay doors open. I think that would frighten me more than that bomb would. I mean, the thing that I think I've learned a lot about listening to these veterans who, you know, served in combat or even training, you know, back home, is how many ways there are to die when you're in the armed forces.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think most people think, oh, I got, you know, you go into a war like World War II and you get shot down by an enemy fighter and you die, or you get shot by an enemy bullet or all that. But there were probably a much larger percentage of people who died from accidents associated with stuff like this.
Yeah.
Than there was people who died in direct, you know, combat with the enemy,
mm-hmm.
whether it was training missions, whether it was accidents, landing on a carrier in the Pacific when he got home from a mission, whether it was some bomb that got armed or magnesium pellets from the bomb ahead of you, like we talked earlier, the
right.
type of incendiaries that didn't work well, they dispersed too much, landing on your planes and causing them to go down. I mean, there are just way too many ways to die when you're in a, situation like this. And, you know, this is just one more example of, holy crap, men were doing this probably, maybe not daily, but maybe when you have 1,000 bomber raids going on for months at a time. I mean, more than I think we realize.
Did your dad ever talk about when they would bring bombs back? Did any bombers land with live bombs?
You know, he never really did. Not to me anyway, no. I'm just
wondering what the process would be once the bomber's on the ground with a live bomb. What do you do then? You know,
we need to look into that. I don't know if they were forced to ditch, if they would have some special protocol for landing with live bombs on board. I'm sure it was a unique protocol. I'm sure it wasn't just land.
So there's a little paragraph in his manuscript here.
Okay. All right.
Says when a crew brings back its bombs for any reason, then the ordnance crews go back to the flight line, unload the bombs, and return them to the revetment. I hated to hear it, but sometimes the bombs were dropped in the channel. However, it did make it easier on the ordnance and armament men.
All right. An empty bomber on the way home is a happy ordnance crew.
Yeah, happy ordnance crew. That's right.
One thing that he did, it wasn't with the bombs, but one thing he mentioned one time was like when they came back, you know, bomb load or not, but anyway, he said, oh, sometimes that the, I guess the waste gunners or any gunners actually on the plane would have been firing those 50 calibers so much that the rifling in the barrels would actually melt.
Yeah, I can.
And
that.
He said if we didn't have a spare barrel at the time, we actually hammered a temporary sleeve down in the barrel of that gun until we got a new barrel.
Now that I didn't know, that they could just go ahead and kind of put like a barrel sleeve patch in it until they got a proper barrel to replace it.
Yeah.
And it also speaks to what the conditions are up in the air for those air crews if they're shooting out these 50 caliber barrels, right?
Right.
That means there's a lot of things to shoot at, which means there's a lot of things shooting at them.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, would they be... How accurate would they be when they have to do that? I mean,
I'm sure they would lose some accuracy. They sleeve barrels even today for worn out barrels on.
Oh, really?
Guns that are collectible. They're not as accurate, but they're better than the shot out barrel. And they're it's a good wartime expedient to just keep that 50 cal in action.
It's like a retread on a semi-truck.
Exactly, right? Yeah. A retread's not as good, but it works, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to jump back in as he talks about this event that happened to a couple of bombers in his group.
Over Pearl. What was that country was that? Belgium, I think. Mm. And so our own two, I guess on the way or on the way back, I think it's on the way back, but I'm not sure. On one of the routes, the two planes collided, and I think one man lived, and I've got that in the computer too. The bomb, the collision between the two bombs of our own men. Mm. Of course, every one of them died, except I think one on each plane didn't.
Wow.
Now that's a story. And now at Pearl over there, they have a memorial for the 385th Bomb Group. Memorializing these boys and what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And people in Belgium just love Americans for, you know, not only the Air Force, but all Americans, and still do. Mm-hmm. And I know one of the guys is from Belgium that I interview with, and I think somebody said something against us one day, and he knocked him out of the bar.
Really?
he really, this really happened.
Wow.
But, you know, they were starving. Mm-hmm. The Germans wouldn't let them have anything. So they're literally starving, and we drop. And I flew, even though I was ground crew and ordnance, I flew on a couple of those food missions myself. Nobody shoot at, but I was there.
That was after the war ended.
Yeah.
Right after it ended, you guys flew.
Yeah. That's when we could take the food to them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they could do it before that, but all that gas and money was spent in planes was spent bombing them. Mm-hmm. So it was after.
So you got over to England in summer of 1942. And you were there for 3 years. You were there until the war ended.
Yeah, I was there the whole day.
Everybody else was doing their 25 or 30 missions.
Yeah, crews could go home after that.
But you were, but the ground crew stayed.
I forget what the 8 mission was. That the average? So that a man could go or a crew could go, and when you beat that and go your 25. You're lucky.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that 8 was the average.
Yeah, I think it was. And better check it with an expert on that. But maybe it's 12, 8 to 12. It's just
8 to 12.
For safety, let's just say it could be, because I'm not sure.
So I just got a couple of things I want to cover with that segment. First of all, the most recent thing he just said there, the average life expectancy for a crew is 8 missions, 8 to 12 missions. And I hadn't considered that before until I asked him that question, which was, wait a second, you were there for the duration. You know, of course, the bomber crews, they had a more deadly job, you know. And so they made their 25 missions. I agree they should go home. That's, you know, because look, the Air Force lost a staggering number of men. It was like it was the highest casualty rate of almost of any unit in World War II, I believe.
On a percent basis.
Yeah.
If you look at the percentage of casualties of men lost, wounded, killed, I believe it was the highest in the European theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it's second only to the German U-boats and German infantry. So it was really high. But you raise a good point, Ryan. A lot of the people we've interviewed have been on the bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just happy to finish their 25 or 30 or 35 missions. It kept growing as the war went on.
Yep.
And the survival rate went up for a whole host of reasons. And then these guys would often, because the people we talk to, right, this is survivorship bias. Right, the only people we can talk to are the ones that actually made their 25 or 30 missions. So those individuals talk about a time period where they may have only been there for 6 months, Yeah. Because they went through those missions. Now, those 6 months were frightening and horrifying. But then this is an interesting interview with ground crew, the people. You know, we've got Dave, his son, sitting here right to the right of me, and we're listening to George. And those guys, they were there for the whole duration. There was no, hey, yeah, you know, you've been here a year, did a good job, you get to go home now. It's like, no, you're going to be here until this war is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he mentions that it took them 45 minutes to load one plane, but they had two planes per crew that they had to load. So that'd be an hour and a half worth of work at least there. That's just to load it.
And that's just one sortie.
That's right? Correct.
Sometimes they would do two to three, he said, a day.
Yeah.
And then there was a lot of other things that I presume. That's just to load the bomber.
Mm-hmm.
But I presume there was a lot more time that also went into going to the revetments, securing the different types of bombs you need to pull. He talked earlier in the clips about pulling them out, putting them on 4x4s and laying them all out so they could see them. I think the 45 minutes is pretty good once the bombs were there, they're on the planes.
Right.
But yeah, these guys would have just been working their tails off and sleeping when they could have until the crisis after D-Day abated.
And not to mention making sure that all the 50 caliber machine guns were retrofitted or had all the ammunition that they needed for per plane. So a lot of work to do. Yes. I mean, these guys were just hopping all the time.
Yep. Yep.
So, all right. And then he mentioned the mid-air collision in the museum in Pearl, Luxembourg. So what I'm going to talk about now is actually I'm on their website. And if you go to www.385bg.lu, that LU is for Luxembourg, that'll take you to this 385th Bomb Group Museum website. And they have, now this is the location where the planes crashed, okay, Pearl, Luxembourg, and that's why there's this memorial there. But I want to read about the, you know, they've got a page here about what happened on July the 12th, 1944. And it's this mid-air crash that happened between two B-17 bombers from this bomb group. It says here, we are the 12th July 1944 at around 11:50. That's around almost noon. 385th Bomb Group of the U.S. Air Force was on its way. The English is a bit sketchy here. Was on its way from Ashfield, Great Britain, to its 150th mission in Munich, Germany. It was a convoy of American B-17 Flying Fortresses as they flew over the village of Pearl, Luxembourg. For till today, unknown reasons, two of them collided. From the group reports, it seems that one of the aircraft that was being piloted by Captain White was caught in the prop wash of the preceding one, nosed up and hit another one that was piloted by First Lieutenant McDonald. Only two members of the two crews survived the impact by parachuting out. The rest of the crews, 18 members in total, died in the accident. We estimate that most of the airmen were ejected from their plane at the moment of impact because the bodies were found scattered in the area between Pearl and Woolwillange. Mm-hmm. They were transported to the old school in Pearl in order to identify the bodies. Seeing that it was impossible to celebrate a requiem for the soldiers who died during the Nazi occupation, a ceremony took place in the Church of Pearl on 17 October 1944 at 6:30 in the evening after the liberation by the Americans. 18 candles and 18 helmets, one for each airman, were placed in the church to honor them.
To me, the other element of the story that's big outside of the sacrifice of these men, that they died in this basically mid-air collision, this accident, is the comment that George made about the affection that not just the Belgians have, but Northern Europeans generally, also in the Netherlands, in Luxembourg, in Normandy. You know, we were just there a couple of years ago, and we got a chance to witness that firsthand. I've become kind of internet friends with a guy named Burton Lux, who lives in Belgium, and he sends me. They just erected a brand new memorial associated with a downed pilot of an air crew who just recently got identified. He was from the Denver area. It was covered by Jeremy Hubbard on Fox News 31, who covered us at the time. They still do this. There is an affinity. You know, in a world where all you see on the news is people burning American flags and effigies of the United States, and you hear about China and others saying, look, we're tired of having this United States hegemon and we want a new world order, there's still plenty of people out there, plenty of allies that support what we did and what we do. And it's good to hear that.
Yeah, it really is.
Now, Dave, didn't you talk about visiting? So there's a 385th Bomb Group museum in mm-hmm. Belgium, right?
Right.
Now, didn't you visit?
Well, it was actually in Luxembourg.
In Luxembourg, okay. Didn't you end up visiting that with your dad when they opened it?
We did.
And what was that like? How did people receive you guys?
Oh, it was just great. It was just like, you know, people were so excited. The groups were there, and yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah. So did you get a sense that the locals appreciated what the Americans did during this time in history and were there to honor them?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, very much so. And actually, not in Luxembourg, but Dad and Mom actually went back to Great Ashfield a few times.
Oh, really?
To reunions out there. And I guess it was a gratitude, but also one time Mom was standing there and this young kid walked up to her and said, "I don't know if you might want these," because they were surrounded by farms back then and still, because it's out in the middle of nowhere pretty yeah. much. And he comes up to Mom and gives her like four or five 50 caliber shell casings.
Oh, that's so cool.
They they dug it up while they were plowing their fields and stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Those guys would test fire their guns when they would, you know, not usually over land. They do it over the channel and stuff. But still, I mean, there's stuff going on all over the place out there.
Yeah, they would have had firing ranges. They would have had all that. There's plenty of opportunity to collect the detritus of war. But at any rate, I thought it's cool that you had a chance to go visit that with your father when he was alive and be honored that way. And then to hear George talk about the reception as well. That's really cool that we have allies like that in this world.
The website is really interesting. They've got photos of the crash, the debris field of the B-17s and all the local civilians out there climbing around and stuff. You know, it's kind of morbid, but they were out there. They were curious. They were looking what they could do here. And, you know, there's pictures of a couple girls and their dogs sitting by the twisted wreckage of one of the planes. Another picture of a girl sitting inside the fuselage of one of the planes here. Mm. And it's just a twisted, just gnarly mess. The whole thing is. Pretty tragic, but it's a great memorial website here, for these
crews. What's the web address again?
And it's, www.385bg for 358th Bomb Group, .lu for Luxembourg.
Okay, worth
and,
keeping out.
Yeah, go check it out. And there's a museum and they have their operating hours and everything. So, maybe we'll get a chance to visit that someday.
Yeah, we'll be there awesome. Next year, next winter.
Yep.
We should make a stop.
We'll do that. So, all right. Well, we're about to wrap this up here. What we're going to talk about now is just some thoughts that George had regarding, the lack of German fighter participation toward the end of the war and another story. So we'll get into that, and then we'll wrap things up here.
And later in the war, when it they got so the Germans didn't have hardly any air force to put up. So we'd been shooting them out and all other things out of the sky. And their experienced fighters were pilots, were all fighter pilots were mostly gone. Mm-hmm. And so they had inexperienced flyers right at the end. Mm-hmm. Pilots sometimes, well, this is a funny thing. I was in charge of this detail of taking the pilots' guns from them, and I don't know how they got the guns, but I think it was by the crew that was carrying them. And these that just came from overseas, and I think we took them from them and go get them back. I'm sure. Oh no. They took them away from them because at one time, because they were if they were downed, and anyone who came around a cruise and they saw you were armed, they'd shoot you. Mm. Now I think that's the truth. If they saw you were armed, they'd shoot you. So they didn't let the cruise carry 45. What good would it do them anyway?
Oh, really? Were there a lot of crews who were resistant to giving up their firearms?
That I don't know. Yeah, but they'd rather do that. But if they were down, well, they could always throw it away.
Wow, that's true.
Yeah, they wanted to. But anyway, we were taking them apart and storing them, those guns, and Maciello was the guy's name. I knew those guns pretty well. He clicked that gun a couple of times. And he's starting to put it away. So, Joe, let me see that gun. Looking at it, and that sounded funny. So I shoot it down to the ground. It still sounded like, bang. Then sent one in with a bullet in.
Oh, my gosh.
with the cartridge. And wow. Then they went and made a chip in the concrete. And I don't know where the bullet went. But the Army, you don't think about where bullets go. Mm-hmm. That was sort of a funny thing. Funny that I could hear that when it dry fired. That's called dry firing. Dry firing is when you pull the trigger and nothing in the chamber, though. Mm-hmm. And it just had a sound that just didn't sound right. And it sure wasn't right. They weren't supposed to give guns up with ammunition in them, live bullets.
That's our last clip there and everything. I thought that was interesting that he was the one who had to be the guy who take the guns from the crew. You know, he's the ordnance guy. He's a weapons specialist, you know. And I just wondered, you know, how many of those guys are like, get out of here. I ain't giving my gun up. You know, that's all I'm going to have between me and the Germans. You know, what if a group of hostile city people come at me and they're going to kill me no matter what? I'm going to take a few with me.
Well, and George was right. He's like, you know, I'd rather have the gun and land. You can always throw it away.
That's
if you
correct.
Feel like you're under danger. But at least you got the darn thing.
Yeah.
That story about the misfiring or whatever, I actually heard that. He told me that story about that gun one time.
Yeah.
And I was thinking it was like a kind of like a, I don't know which model he was in, like kind of like a machine gun, actually.
Wow.
But he was sitting there pulling the triggers, like, that sounds weird. And it said, I thought he said something like there was like packing oil in the barrel, and then finally, the chamber finally opened up. Pow.
You can hear me. He goes like, wow. It went off the concrete. And I love that. You know, we're in the Army. We don't really pay attention to where the bullet goes.
Right.
We don't really care where the bullet goes.
We just wanted to fire. Who cares like, where it goes, right?
Oh, okay, we're good to go.
So we're obviously at the end of the interview here and everything with all the clips we have. George's story. I mean, I remember whenever I was doing the interview, the detail he had on the loading and the process and everything. And with the mind he had, you know, obviously he was a really intelligent man. He's a doctor. You know, he was a photographer. He was a pilot. As you tell, David was telling us that his dad later got his pilot's license, his commercial pilot's license, and they had airplanes when David was young, and they'd fly all over the place and do some cool things, you know?
And that's how I'd kind of like to end this interview then. We've got your son here, David. Tell as much as you can know, you know, what kind of man your dad was. What kind of father was he?
Well, that's a good question, actually. He actually was a great dad. I probably started crying.
That's okay.
It's okay.
That's all right.
Well, one of my heroes. I'm sorry.
You don't need to apologize for this.
David. We're really happy that you came out here to help honor your dad's memory.
So,
and I know that it's got to be hitting you hard at times, you know, and it's been what you said, he passed away in 2010, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so 13 years later, but it's never any easier.
No, it's not.
Can I share with the audience something you shared with me a little while ago about his funeral?
Sure.
So what Dave was telling us at his funeral is someone doing the eulogy said something to the effect of George was the kind of guy who his time on this earth, he didn't create a lot of waves or ripples, but he left a huge wake.
Isn't that amazing?
And we talked about that. And that to me, that's what I love about having you here, Dave, is to be able to hear your father again, to be able to more personalize this person. Historians can look at these interviews as like data, right? And this isn't data. These are experiences from human beings that lived with us, that had kids like yourself. And I really appreciate you being here today with us. Is there
Is there anything else you want to or can add at this point? given that I asked kind of a molly whopper of a question.
Yeah.
Good job, Tony.
I know.
Well, I can tell a regular story, and I don't remember one of his friends from the bomb group. Mm-hmm. His granddaughter, because Dad was sort of the, what would be his title? Secretary, maybe, of the three, well, I don't know if it was just the 385th or the 550th, but there was every year they'd have a reunion somewhere. Yeah. And so Dad was the contact for the group anyway. He got emails from all over the country and whatnot. But this guy had contacted Dad, hey, I don't know if you can help my granddaughter or not, but she's struggling in math in like high school. He goes, well, yeah, I could give it a go. Because Dad would tutor local kids at the schools and whatnot.
What did he do? How did he have time to have a
family?
He
was a wrestling coach, too. I mean.
Yeah, was a wrestling coach until a few years after I got into high school, actually.
A pilot, a dentist, a father. But please continue with the story. Yeah.
Anyway, so he got in touch with this guy's granddaughter. And basically, he tutored her over the computer because she was halfway across the country from him. Yeah. And he would send her tests on the computer. She would do them. She would send them back. He would grade them and tell her yes or no, or this is what you need to have done on that and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that is a novel to me, first of all, that someone from the World War II generation was using a computer.
they were doing remote learning.
Yes. Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, he was obviously not intimidated by new technology, could handle and tackle anything, really, that he set his mind to. Yeah. Not intimidated by a damn thing.
No. Yeah, he, so it was pretty cool. In fact, the girl kept in touch for a while. After she goes, yeah, I'm now like an A student.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I know.
What I remember about your dad, really, just in the brief time that I knew him, which was during this interview, was just a gentle, soft-spoken guy that was very good at his job, a very accomplished person, and took great pride in what he had done. He obviously, he's written up, some of his memories here. You mentioned earlier, while we were off camera, that you found out that he had handwritten copies of the 385th Bomb Group, right?
Yes, the original records.
Their original records. And where do they reside now?
They're in the 8th Air Force Museum in Savannah, Georgia.
That's fantastic. You know, Tony and I, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there, you hear about veterans passing away and you know that they've got a footlocker somewhere in their attic with all their photos and records and maybe whatever they brought back with them from the theater.
Yeah.
And you always fear that the kids didn't know what it was. They just pitched it. It's in a landfill somewhere. And think about the history that's in some of these landfills, you know. But I'm so happy that you guys had the wherewithal and the knowledge and the thought to send this and donate it to the museum.
Yeah, there's that war museum in Muskogee where they have the batfish.
The batfish, sure.
Okay. Well, I actually made a copy, just from Xerox copy of that, those bombing records, and let them have it too.
Do you still do you have a copy of that somewhere, like in a PDF or something that we could put on our website?
We'll talk. I don't know. Maybe
we'll talk about it later. But if you have that, those are the sort of things we like to put on the website for every veteran we feature. Are things like that, so other people can go and not only listen to the podcast and hear what we recorded today, but also see some of these other things that we discussed. Did he bring anything back from the war that you remember?
You know, from World War II, not that I know of. Now, because he actually was a two-time vet.
Oh, was he in the Korean War as well?
He was actually a dentist in the Navy in the Korean War.
Oh,
so he actually wasn't scheduled to go to Korea, but by that time, my sister and my brother had already been born.
Okay.
And because my sister was born before, basically before World War II. My brother was born after.
Yeah.
When he came back. And anyway, so he was actually stationed in Norfolk, Virginia. And he was actually the wrestling coach for the Norfolk, Virginia Naval Base Wrestling Team.
Imagine that.
But he had a fellow doctor that was about to have his first kid that was supposed to go to Korea. He goes, you know what? You need to stay. Mm. I'm going in your place, buddy.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep. And I know my older sister, about that time, she was already like over 11. Well, no, she wasn't quite that old because she's just over 11 years older than me, but pretty close to 11 maybe at that time when he first left. And she goes, they were in Norfolk, and she goes, yeah, he was out in this little dinghy going out to the ship. And she goes, when I realized he wasn't coming back, I started to scream.
Oh, yeah.
And he was on a what they called a destroyer tender. Mm-hmm. It was basically a supply ship, and they had all the doctors on the ship, too. So, but yeah, it was huge. We actually have a picture of it with about 7 destroyers tied up next to it.
Wow.
Pretty big boat.
They can replenish like torpedoes and armament, food, all that stuff.
All the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Do you still have the picture of that as well?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm going to ask you on air to like apply some peer pressure to you. But any of those things that you can share with us, we sure would like to be able to share it with our audience as well. I think they'd like to see it.
Yeah. I can get them to you one of these days somehow.
Sure. Or okay, audience, you just heard Dave commit to this. Let's see if he's a man of his word. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Well, David, again, thank you so much for coming out here and participating in this with us. It's a meaningful thing for us, and I can tell it's a touching thing for you also. Is there anything else you want to say?
I think I'm good. We're good.
Okay. Thanks for making the trip out to the Green
Sure.
Barn.
Sure.
And we'll sign off on this. So
my name is Ryan Fairfield.
And I'm Tony Lupo, and thanks for joining another amazing episode of The Warrior Next Door.
This concludes the George Mankoff series, the story of a B-17 bomb ordnance officer of the 385th Bomb Group stationed in Great Ashfield, England during World War II. We want to thank Dr. George Mankoff for his service during the war and also for his fine examples of being a great dad, friend, and mentor to those in his wake. We also want to thank his son, David Mankoff, for joining us for this series and adding some personal anecdotes about his dad.
Well, thanks for joining us. If you like what you hear, please like us at the Warrior Next Door podcast Facebook page. All of our interviews are archived at the Veterans History Project, Library of Congress, and also with our partner at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.